gloria Domini, in saecula laetabitur Dominus in operibus suis. Receri Domine maritum Britonni, Titanis vitibis qualinique sonus, Seum iden favori modulis venerando fin, Se iumeos flagitam variis liberare mai.
Domini, humili, magne martir sabini, abini, omnes venerabili, et tutor laudabili tuos subitos. Serva carnis fragili, mole potito.
Hi, I'm Stan Brakhage. I want to talk today about one of the greatest filmmakers, Orson Welles, a man who in a different time I've always thought could probably, might have been the Shakespeare of film. He had all that kind of strong personality as to control the economics, to control the stage setting and casts of, in some cases of films he made later, hundreds of people. And on the stage, the complications to be producer and director and to deal with the temperamentality of actors and actresses and so on. And none of this killed the sensitivity that he had as a child, which had him reading, quoting from memory Shakespeare before 5 years old, performing with a little puppet theater his Shakespeare productions. Actually, we weren't ready for a renaissance yet, and so he ends up the fool of Johnny Carson in some sad sense, or of Dean Martin, and can't seem to make films anymore at all, or stage productions. He's also a man very involved in politics all his life, and worked under the Roosevelt administration, which makes the piece that I'm about to play for you even more surprising. He also loved and based all his work on the Bible. And here we have a strange piece coming through the recent years of his own writing, his questioning of the Great Society under Lyndon Johnson, and eventually his attacks on the Vietnam War. Anyway, I'll let him speak for himself. Here's Orson Welles in his own script and reading The Begetting of the President.
In the beginning, LBJ created the Great Society, and darkness was upon the face of the Republicans, and the spirit of consensus moved across the land. And LBJ said, "Let us continue." And they continued. The evening and the morning, the first day. And LBJ said, "Let us make war on poverty." And lo, there were welfare checks fallen upon the land, and upon them it was writ, "Hold not. Saw that it was good." And the evening and the morning for the second day. And LBJ said, "Let there be a civil rights covenant to unite the children of light and darkness." And so it came to pass the Congress. The evening and the morning for the third day. And LBJ said, "Let there be Medicare, that the sick may be healed and the doctors paid under the fullest measure thereof." And LBJ saw that it was paid. And the evening and the morning were the fourth day. And LBJ said, "Let there be bureaus and departments without number, and let them be fruitful and multiply, so that every critter that flieth, creepeth, or voteth shall be blessed with patronage, each in his own precinct." And LBJ saw that it was finger-licking good. And the evening and the morning were the fifth day. And LBJ said, "Let there be nuclear non-proliferation, and let the capitalist lie down with a commissar, that they may exchange corn and out his pole and saw that it was good, even unto the 10th cubit. And the evening and the morning of the 6th day. And LBJ saw the society it made, and behold, it was great. And on the 7th day he gave a barbecue. Still, LBJ rested not from his labors, but said, shucks, let there be an 8th day. And on the 8th day, he escalated.
I can join that piece of music, which is Sergei Rachmaninoff's Prelude in C-sharp minor, with Orson Welles' escalating of the Great Society, because I do deeply believe that music is not abstract, that it's just another way of thinking, and that there are patterns which are expressed through music which do reflect directly whatever most blunt political troubles or world crises we're either trying to survive or are perhaps trapped in. That piece of music is to me one of the most beautiful pieces of music written in the 20th century, but it's also one of the most successfully classical. It's built of a very particular structure that people are entirely used to, or at least were at the time that he composed it and played it over and over again, as Rachmaninoff was also a great concert pianist. And in fact, the magic of this particular record is that this is as exact a recreation of Rachmaninoff playing the piano as you will ever hear. It's done through a particularly sensitive system, a player piano, that actually, instead of being holes punched in paper, was quills dipped in mercury, so that when Rachmaninoff performed on that piano, the slightest tremolo of his playing was recorded and traced, and that performance can be recreated much better than any of the by now very old records that were made of him. Anyway, my reason for playing it was to listen to a kind of very extraordinarily beautiful but somehow musical trap out of the 19th century. And that piece, the Prelude in C-sharp minor, had become a trap for Rachmaninoff himself. He was always asked to play it. Everywhere he went, it was so popular, and he came to hate it worse than any piece of music ever composed. So it is with most people and the Bible. The Bible has come to them in forms and been used in so many ways, unhappily, for their torment and for their restriction, that the great beauty of the Bible itself has come to be difficult to turn to. And yet it does still remain, at least in America, the base of almost all writing. It and Shakespeare were the two books that made it across the plains, you know, even after the cow died and the covered wagon was stuck somewhere, the family still carried those two books. And you can hear it very clearly all the way through The Journal of Albion Moonlight by Kenneth Patchen.
Science cuts up little pigs in order that men may be free of disease. Science points expensive instruments at the stars. What are they cutting me up for? Why did they invent things which could be pointed at me? Murderers. Getting money for making things to blow their fellows to hell. Make a dollar. Make a dollar. I have said that you are not to kill anyone. Tear up all those blueprints. Submarines. Think of a submarine. Of a war tank. What sort of monsters conceive these things? What in the name of God are men capable of doing? These slim, well-dressed men sitting at desks and drawing things on paper, what are they making? Are these designs for bridges and homes? Are they planning to make me happier? These men are respected. They take their money and buy tomatoes and meat and wine. They laugh. They dance with their women, with their hands. Their hands are covered with blood. Planning machines that tear schoolboys into a million pieces. Make an honest dollar. Well, you will say, Da Vinci did. He thought up most of these things first. I answer, he was a murderer too. He tried to make murder an art. But murder is only murder. See how deep this goes. We must learn to live, to feel about one another for the first time. Murder has been in the hearts of everyone who has ever lived. It must be taken out. Our images must be destroyed. These tales of death and destruction, weed them all out. Accounts of war and conquest, dusty, bloody helmets in the hands of school children. All of this must go. We have no use for that kind of history. Tell me how the birds build their nests. Tell me what the farmer sings at his plow. I refuse to hear how some besotted madmen set whole nations at each other's throats. I won't listen. A leaf falls to the ground. The eye of a rabbit has seen it. Make me such a design.
And the design that I chose to put with Patchen's piece from the Journal of Albion Moonlight is Wien Nachten, or Vienna Night, by Joseph Matthias Hauer. And the reason that I did that is I know no other human that's tried so hard as he did in this century to deflect the history of music from the kind of use of it to create power and swelling of emotion, such as is beautifully epitomized by Rachmaninoff's Prelude in C-sharp minor. Hauer rejected all of those constructs, those familiar constructs that were so rooted in the emotions of people that that they would feel great power and great strength and great surety, great passion, tragedy, so forth. Hauer wanted music to become, as I think Patchen is calling for, a reflection of the designs of simple living and of beautiful, peaceful thinking. He was the first man to create the 12-tone system of music. And instead of this giving him a peaceful life, along came Arnold Schoenberg, not long after, and absolutely independent of Hauer, and created a 12-tone system of music, which did incorporate within itself even more of a sense of power and strength and emotional fervor and drama. And as if not to, and I mean even further difficult for Hauer, along came Alban Berg, who created some of the most powerful, bloody operas of the 20th century, capable of dealing even with Jack the Ripper in music. And poor Hauer sat there with his beautiful, quiet pieces in absolute poverty in Vienna, slowly sending out his music, which wasn't played, occasionally playing it himself. And his fury mounted across the years, and until he finally was making a stamp that he'd put on all his letters saying, Joseph Matthias Hauer, the original creator of 12-tone music, etc. In other words, he too didn't escape a war of a sort. But the music is beautiful, simple, and alternative. And finally, he was recognized. There's a wonderful story I have to share with you about Hauer. Finally, the city of Vienna, which always did try to honor its artists and give them a stipend, help them to survive, came to him with an award that's usually given to anyone that's achieved any kind of international fame in their 20s. He was in his late 60s or 70s when they finally arrived at his slum-dwelling little room, knocked on the door. He came to the door in his shorts, as it happened, and they held out this award to him, and he threw up his hands and he said, I knew you were coming. So he did get some kind of honor at the end. Patchen rejects, of course, Leonardo da Vinci, also a murderer, all of culture, all of artists even at times, all of books. If you remember, he refers to these great big-bottomed ash cans into which men dump their souls. And this rejection of the arts must always be mixed with some sense that also out of the arts comes the antidote, that the Bible cannot be an occasion trusted by everybody as an occasion of solemnity does not prevent it from continuing to be the basis of rhythms of the language that we hold, and many of the concepts too, and or even an occasion for gentle humor, which sees in the whole of the flood, the biblical flood, an occasion for praising the simple things of daily life. Robert Duncan's The Ballad of Mrs. Noah.
The Ballad of Mrs. Noah. Mrs. Noah in the ark wove a great nightgown out of the dark, did Mrs. Noah. Had her own hearth in the holy boat, two cats, two books, two cooking pots, had Mrs. Noah, two pints of porter, two pecks of peas, and a stir in her stew of memory. Oh, that was a town, said Mrs. Noah, that the Lord in his wrath did up and drown. I liked its windows and I liked its trees. Save me a little, Lord, I prayed on my knees. And now, Lord, save me, I've two of each, apple, apricot, cherry, and peach. How shall I manage it? I've two of them all, hairy, scaly, leathery, slick, fluttery, buttery, thin, and thick, shaped like a stick, shaped like a ball, too tiny to see and much too tall. I've all that I asked for and more and more. Windows and chimneys and a great store of needles and pins, of outs and ins, and a regular forgiveness for some of my sins. She wove a great nightgown out of the dark, decorated like a Sunday park, with clouds of black thread to remember her grief, sewn about with five flowers to give relief. And in a grim humor, a border all round, with the little white bones of the wicked drowned. Tell me, brother, what do you see? Said Mrs. Noah to the lowly worm. Oh, mother, the earth is black, black, to my crawly bride and lowly me. The earth is bitter as can be, where the dead lie down and never come back, said the blind worm. Tell me, brother, what do you see? Said Mrs. Noah to the sleeping cat. Oh, mother, the weather is dreadful wet. I'll keep house for you wherever you'll be. I'll sit by the fireside and be your pet. Then as long as I'm dry, I'll purr for free, said snug, loving cat. Tell me, brother, has the flood gone? Said Mrs. Noah to the searching crow. No, no, no home in sight. I fly through the frightful waste alone, said the carrion crow. The world is an everlasting night. Now that can't be true, Noah, old Noah, said the good housewife to her good spouse. How long must we go in this floating house, growing old and hope cold, husband, without new land? And then, glory be, with a rainbow to boot, the dove returned with an olive shoot. Tell me, brother, what have we here, my love, to the dove, said Mrs. Noah. It's a branch of all cheer you may wear on your nightgown all the long year as a boa, Mrs. Noah, said the dove, with God's love. Then out from the ark, in her nightgown all dark, with only her smile to betoken the day, and a wreath round of olive leaves, Mrs. Noah stepped down into the same old, wicked, repenting, Lord will we ever, recently recovered, comfortable world town. Oh, where have you been, Mother Noah, Mother Noah? I've had a great promise for only tomorrow. In the ark of sleep, I've been on a sail over the wastes of the world's sorrow. And the promise, the tomorrow, Mother Noah, Mother Noah. Ah, the rainbows awake, and we will not fail.
Two of my very favorite people conjoined there, the poet Robert Duncan in his Ballad of Mrs. Noah, and the American composer Samuel Barber in the first of his hermit songs, in this case sung by Leontine Price. And that's all for today. We move on to Charles Ives and the New River.